Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host today, Matt Watson. Very excited to be joined with Mr. Mike Stemple today and his company, Inspire. He's done a whole lot of things in his career, and we'll talk all about it, but we're primarily going to talk about being an entrepreneur today and trying to be even more entrepreneurial. So excited to talk all about that. But before we get started, today's episode of Startup Hustle is powered by Fullscale.io. Hiring software developers is difficult. Fullscale can help you build a software team quickly and affordably and has the platform to help you manage that team. Visit Fullscale.io to learn more. Mike, welcome to the show, man. I love nothing more than talking about entrepreneurship. So excited for the conversation today.
Well, I've been an entrepreneur my whole life, so I probably have a lot to say.
Well, tell us a little about your journey. Before we got started here, you mentioned, made it sound like you were, I don't know, were you a professional athlete? You've been an artist, you're an entrepreneur, and a lot of different things. Tell us about your background.
I have the most eclectic background, and I think that just leads me to being on the pathway to success I've been on. Let me start at the beginning. I'm ex-military. I joined the Army straight out of high school. I was a combat medic, enlisted, and did very well. So well, they asked me to leave. They didn't kick me out. They asked me to leave and offered to pay for my undergraduate to become a doctor, come back as an Army surgeon. So I went down that path and got through my senior year of college, and I was in a car accident. And my head hit the door frame of a car, and in blink of an eye, I lost both my military and my medical future.
Oh, man.
And it was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me. Other than, you know, rupturing all my teeth and having root canals on all my molars and tearing my eye and my neck and everything, the part of my brain I hit on the front temporal on the right side is the creativity center. And I damaged an area adjacent to the creativity center, and it sparked creativity in me, uncontrollable creativity. Every single piece of blank paper I saw around me, I imagined artwork on it. And so I started to paint. And 6 months after my head injury, I painted one of the largest murals in Colorado history. I'm from Denver, Colorado, grew up there. And it was a 40-foot by 80-foot mural featuring John Elway, Dikembe Mutombo of the Nuggets, and Andre Scalarraga of the Rockies. And it became kind of a hallmark, career-setting, huge, huge project that became the most visible artist in Colorado. And took me on a wild path. I started doing artwork for pro athletes and created hundreds upon hundreds of pieces of art.
Wow.
In my late 20s. Yeah, so that was the first big exposure I had to working with brands like the pro sports teams and working with personal brands like pro athletes. And also just marketing yourself. How do you market yourself? And so this is the late 90s, and the internet was just kicking into high gear. And my younger brother had just graduated with a computer science degree and was telling me about this thing called the internet. And I looked into it, and I became fascinated with how web pages were displayed. just the code underneath making something visual. And so I taught myself to code and came up with some ideas, and I got my first startup funded in 2000. And the first three failed spectacularly. But that's okay. The fourth one did all right. I created a company called Skinit, stickers for cell phones and laptops. And it's still in business to this day, and millions upon millions of people have ordered Skinits for their phones. And it kind of became my first big exit.
Did you create a lot of the art for those?
I did it. But Skinit was this, it was this, I finally learned one of the secrets to being a successful entrepreneur is don't work on an idea unless you have a credible claim personally to be involved in it. So for example, if you're single and you don't have kids, it's probably not a good idea to make build a company that helps parents manage their kids, for example, right? Because you don't have kids, so you have no credible claim to be in that. But Skinit, I did have a credible claim. It was a marriage of technology and art and physical manufacturing, on-demand physical manufacturing, and all areas I was interested in and passionate about, and I had a credible claim to do it. And it took off like a hockey stick. And on November 11th, 2004, we launched, and profitable from day one, crashed our web servers with orders the very first day. Took us 3 months to catch up. To this day, thousands upon thousands of orders happen every single day.
So is it your fault that everybody puts stickers on their laptops now?
Yes. Before me, if you go all the way back to 2004, it was funny. 2004 was like this pivotal time because all these consumer electronics, to give you an idea that the popular phones out was the Palm Pilot.
Yeah.
Palm Pilot PDAs, BlackBerry phones, XM radio had just launched. So the little portable XM radio thing. Compaq was still in business.
I created mobile apps for some of those things you just mentioned. So
my company right before Skinit was called InReach, and I was in the mobile content business. And I sold InReach to a public company that eventually went under. But I was doing the same thing, ringtones, graphics and games, apps for those devices. And I just saw this perfect nexus. Go ahead.
I guess I'm going to have to speak for a lot of IT people out there, because I've been this guy that, you know, an employee leaves and they turn their laptop and it's full of stickers on the back, and I got to clean that crap off. I'm blaming you for that.
You know what I do now? Is every time I just got a new MacBook and I buy a plastic shell and I stick it on the back and then I put my stickers on top.
There you go.
But what's funny is, yeah, because I figure someone else is going to get a hand-me-down somewhere in the next couple of years, and not everyone has the same personalization. Oh, yeah. But the nice thing about Skinit, I pioneered. I worked really hard with 3M, and we had that vinyl. We still have the vinyl. Skinit still has the vinyl. Gray-backed adhesive, it peels clean. There's no residue when you peel it off. It's high-end, and it was just, man, that company was a blast to build. And the things we were working on were the first of its kind, like being able to upload a photo and position it on top of a product and then end up getting that exact design custom cut and shipped to you. There was no SaaS platforms for that. There was no e-commerce code I could buy to enable that. There was no plugins for that. So that was all custom coded stuff back in the day. And it was a fascinating company to build, though. It was just this marriage of personalization, the trend of personalization, and technology. And our clientele skewed heavily women, because if you think about it, most consumer electronics by their very nature are more masculine. They come in silver, black. They come in very masculine, traditional colors, and most of our clientele was women. So we allowed, for the first time, women to express an electronic accessory and personalize it to them. And so that was always fascinating. Most of the media we got was in feminine-oriented media. And I knew I was onto something because my mom got excited and my wife at the time was excited. It seemed women were more excited about Skinit at the start. And that changed heavily when we got into licensing and we started licensing a ton of brands. To this day, Skinit's one of the largest licensees, heavy pro sports.
Okay.
All of Disney, Marvel, I mean, the whole cachet, and then you can move and grab that artwork and pick your device and get this custom cut sticker to make it as unique as you. And so, that hadn't been done before. I mean, so it was weird working with the licenses because they kept on saying, send us a sample of your lot. And we're like, we don't have lots. We don't buy in lots. We make each one at the time of order. We have rolls of vinyl that are white. I can send you that, or I can print out some skins and send them to you. And so that was always one of the challenges, getting them to start thinking about on-demand manufacturing.
So tell me about, you know, your career as you went past Skinit.
Yeah, so I did Skinit, sold it to actually one of our licensing companies bought it. Paul Busp in San Diego bought it. And would spend some time in San Diego, fell in love with it. And that's where I live now, out in San Diego. So I leave Skinit and I decided to do Skinit for cars. So I created a company called Original Wraps, which is basically taking the same business model as Skinit, but doing it for large car companies. And so I partnered with just about every large car company in the world. My older brother and I, he led the company and I kind of helped on the biz dev stuff. And, we got between $1 billion of revenue between the car companies and the small little company called 3M. And so suddenly out of the blue, car companies were signing personalization deals to power wraps for cars directly and rolling it into the financing of the vehicle. And 3M ended up buying Origin Wraps. So my older brother navigated that exit.
So were you guys focused on actually doing the wraps or making the materials and then selling it to all these other people that did the wraps?
The two big areas we focused was the technology platform. So we had a seamless engine that I built at Skinit. So most of Skinit's revenue came from third parties. So we had powered like Disney skins or T-Mobile skins. We did the same thing with the car company. So when you were on VW's website and suddenly you saw an advertisement on there that you can personalize your VW. They ended up on a piece of code that we powered and ran.
Okay.
And then we had all the licenses and designs and we did it both B2B and B2C. So B2C with a consumer that can get pinstripes for their car. But the B2B one was really interesting because if you are a painter and you bought a cargo van from Ford.
Right, yeah.
You can get it wrapped directly from Ford and roll it into your financing.
Yeah. Mike painting or whatever. Like we've all seen those before. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So we worked on that for quite some time. And around a year or two into that, my hands started to shake one day and didn't really notice. Just thought I was tired. But it progressed to twitches all over my body. And then the pain started and I got really sick. And so I bowed out of Original Wraps, turned it over to my older brother to run and monetize. And I spent the next 6 months of my life trying to figure out what was wrong with me. And long story short, at the end of that 6 months, doctor said high probability of either Parkinson's or MS, which is something when you're in your late 30s, you don't want to hear.
Yeah.
And so they gave me this advice. I remember that doctor's visit to this day. If there's anything physical you want to do with your life, now is the time to do it. And so the very next morning I woke up and I have different code that aggregates a ton of content. So kind of a feed reader of sorts. And the very first story in my feed reader that I used was a review of Paulo Coelho's The Alchemist. And in that story, there's this quote, what would you do with your life if you were not afraid? And it was just vividly displayed on my screen. What would you do with your life if you're not afraid? Because I just spent the previous 6 months chasing down my fear, trying to figure out why I was physically sick. And it was just fear after fear after fear, MRIs, CAT scans, all these awful things. And I decided in that moment sitting there that I was going to pick the hardest thing I could imagine to do physically. And I was going to go and achieve it. And so I realized I couldn't climb Everest. I have no background in that, no credible claim to climb Everest, right? So I didn't feel comfortable being on a bike, so I wasn't going to cycle across America. And I figured I could walk, and if I can walk, I could probably run, and figure I used to run in the military. And so I Googled the hardest foot race on the planet. And the very first result was a race that's run in the Atacama, called the Atacama Crossing. Atacama is a desert in northern Chile. It's a high desert, so it's around a mile high. So it's similar in elevation to Denver. And it's the driest place on Earth, 400 times drier than anywhere else. It's just immensely dry. It hasn't rained for 400 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's just brutal. And it's a salt desert. It used to be the ocean floor, and it got pushed up when the Andes were formed. So it's layered in salt everywhere. Beautiful, beautiful place. And I'm reading about this amazing race. It's 156 miles, 250 kilometers, self-supported. You have to, you spend basically a week in the desert with a pack, with everything you need to survive, a week traveling 156 miles. If you ask for a Band-Aid, you're out. So everything has to be in your pack. The only thing they'll give you on the course is water. And people die doing this race, or these type of races. And I was just fascinated with it. I was just like, This is hard. This feels like building a startup. This is daunting. This is utterly impossible, and I'm going to do the impossible. And so I saw it was running in the fall of the next year. So this is October, and I see it's running in fall of the next year. And so I entered it. I didn't even think twice. I entered it, put my credit card in, got the confirmation. And only then did I notice that I had made a big mistake. The Southern Hemisphere has a different fall, spring, summer cadence than we do. Their fall is our spring. Right. And so I was like, oh, I only have 6 months to train for this race. I have to go from sedentary and sick to ultra-endurance athlete. And I called my doctors and told them what I was planning, and they all said it was stupid. And my family all said it was stupid. Everyone in my life at the time just said, you know, accept your situation. Don't be stupid. And I went against everyone's advice, and I started training the very next day. And I treated it like a startup. I was highly disciplined about my diet. I was highly disciplined about what was in my mind, my motivation, everything. And I started walking every day. And, eventually, I got to the point where I was doing 10 miles every day with a pack, with a race pack, with everything I was planning on taking to the desert. And one day, I decided to run a little bit. And then the next day, I ran a little bit more. And 6 months later, I'm on a plane flying down to the Atacama, a city called Calama in the Atacama, and ready to do the hardest thing I could imagine ever doing. And along the way, I stopped twitching, and the pain went away, and the shakes went away. I was healing somehow, and I ended up on a plane ride flying down to run the hardest foot race on the planet.
So how did the race go?
On the flight down, I was taking my race pack, big North Face bag, out of the overhead. Someone bumped me from behind. The bag flipped over behind my head with my hand stuck in the handle. And I rotated my shoulder and tore one of the ligaments on that holds your clavicle to your scapula.
Yeah.
One of those ligaments popped off. And so any weight that was put on my shoulder would cause excruciating pain. And so this is the day before the race. This happens. And I go and see the race doc. And he presses down, and he's like, okay, you're disqualified. And I was like, you don't understand. I start crying. I'm not ashamed to admit this. I was like bawling. I was like, you have no idea what I've been through to end up here today and what this means for me. And I think he took some pity on me. And he goes, you're that tech guy, right? Because we have to submit a bio. And there's about 100 athletes that do this race. And so I had to submit a bio. And I go, yeah, I'm the tech guy. He goes, are you good with math? And I go, I'm pretty good with math. He goes, how many feet are in a mile? I go, 5280. He goes, what's your stride length? I go, probably around 3 feet. He goes, this is 156 miles. I was like, okay. He goes, do the math. And I was kind of crunching. He goes, how many strides are you going to take? I was like, over 250,000. He goes, you're going to separate your shoulder 250,000 times over the next 7 days. He goes, if you can, excuse me, handle that pain, I'll let you run. And he goes, and by the way, you can't have any Advil or any Tylenol in your pack. One, when you're dehydrated, one will damage your kidneys, the other one will damage your liver. So no painkillers on this one. He goes, and if you can do that, then you can do it. And so he worked with me to rig my pack to take some of the weight off, but it transferred everything over to my other shoulder and my hips got out of alignment. And it was just a brutal, brutal 7 days. And on the last big stage, it was 50 miles. I almost died. I got my electrolytes got out of balance. My heart started to beat irregularly. And I thought that was it. I think now in reflection over the years, thought that I was kind of depressed and suicidal, I think, and wanted to go there, wanted to push myself to the brink and die. And I almost did. And it was another amazing pivotal point in my life is when I was sitting on the floor of the Atacama watching a sunset, and I saw the most glorious sunset I've ever seen in my life. It was just solid gold. All the salt crystals got the perfect reflection. It was, felt like I was sitting on a plane of gold. And it was just amazing spiritual moment I had because I looked around and asking for help, and there was just, you spread out really far in this race, and I was down on a bowl. And as far as I could see, I couldn't see another human being. And I realized it was the most lonely I'd ever been. It was the furthest away I'd ever been from another human being in my life, and no one was going to save me. And it was also the loneliest I'd ever been with myself. And I saw that amazing sunset and had this kind of out-of-body experience. And something clicked in my brain. Something just changed again. My heart started to calm down. And I realized that if I could just stand up and take one little step in that moment, then that would be an achievement. If I could just face the end on my feet, that would be awesome. So I got up and I took a little step and it worked. So I hobbled a little bit more and I got a little bit further and I looked back and I could see where I was sitting in the dirt. And I was like, maybe if I just hobble the rest of the way, I can actually finish this thing in the time allotment. And I did. Somehow I made it to the finish line and hobbled 156 miles and achieved one of the hardest things I could ever imagine doing.
That's incredible. That's an incredible story. So ultimately through all of that exercise and changes to your diet and all of that, did it ultimately have a long-term effect on your health issues that you had?
Yeah. So we fast forward again. So I come back from the desert. I decide I'm not going to do startups like the way I've been doing them. I create a company called Inspire because I had this word in my head. The greatest thing you could ever do was to live a life worthy of inspiring others. And so I decided to come back and inspire people and get out of my comfort zone. I've never liked being in front of people. I never liked being on stage. I never liked being interviewed. And so all those things were this new goal of mine, is to get myself out there and out of my comfort zone. And I started mentoring. So I mentored at Founders Institute, became a director of Founders Institute, then started mentoring at Techstars and was giving back heavily, was doing keynotes on stage, and started getting sick again. And went and saw a doc, and the head of MS, one of the top MS doctors in the world. And he kept on having these interns come in and run all these tests on me. Same thing over and over and over all day. And then finally he comes in and he goes, I have good news and I have bad news. I go, shoot, pick your choice. He goes, the good news is you don't have MS. I'm like, okay, that is awesome news. He goes, the bad news is something's damaged in your neck that's causing all this. And when I said, oh yeah, by the way, I was in a car accident when I was 24, hit my head against the door frame. And he just kind of rolled his eyes. He goes, yeah, that's it. He goes, you probably damaged something along your spine, and that's just the symptoms are going to rise and fall, cascade up and down. And so I realized that once again, this amazing moment in my life will have repercussions, both positive and negative, forever. And that's one of the things I think a lot about, is these moments that I've had in my life that at the start of them, they looked tragic, actually ended up amazingly awesome because I chose to make them awesome. I chose to find the silver lining. And so go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I go through this amazing discovery process, and I am advising corporations at this time with my consulting business. It started randomly. A CTO I knew asked me to come in to this large multinational and tell them about this startup stuff I was doing and why startups act the way they do and what do startup founders think and how do they go through their ideation process and how do they build things, and just asking me 1,000 questions about startups. And it was just this, once again, stepping back into the corporate realm. So when I was at Skin and Original Wraps, I partnered with every license, every large company you can imagine, every carrier, hardware manufacturers like HP, Dell, all the car companies. I had worked with all these innovation teams before as a service provider, creating a white label technology solution that they would then slap their logo on and make available to their customers. Now I was on the other side. I was working embedded in an innovation team, looking at the startup community, trying to figure out what startups could help these large multinationals, or whether they should just do it themselves. And in doing that for a decade now, I've been what they call an entrepreneur in residence for hire. I step in as a consultant. I embed usually for 2 years, part-time. I'm not an employee for sure. And my job is to help executives within these large companies think and act more entrepreneurial and really take into account and understand just how dangerous the startup community is to their future. I think a lot of executives in these large companies just completely discount how dangerous, in aggregate, the startup community is to them. And so that's one of the big lessons I try to teach them is, here's a fun exercise. Usually the very first meeting I have, I'll do some research ahead of time. I find 3 startups that are competing against Megacorp. And I'll look at the headcount on LinkedIn at these 3 startups. And I look at job titles. And I come up with a number of how many people within those 3 startups are solely focused on innovating for that startup. No other role, right? So they're not a receptionist or they're not a salesperson. They're creating code and creating intellectual property. Then I go in and I meet with a group of senior executives and I say, these 3 startups have this many people. How many people do you and Megacorp have solely focused on creating innovation, creating intellectual property, whether it's patents, new products, new things? And they're just shocked to find that there's more innovators within 3 startups than a $6 billion entity has around the globe. And then I tell them, this is just 3 startups. You're in, 10 different markets around the globe? And you have thousands of startups that are eating away at your margins every single day, and you're not taking it serious. And go ahead.
Well, so I was going to say, the first company I had, I started in 2003 and I sold it in 2011. It was a CRM system for car dealers. And to this day, it's the number one product in the whole industry. It hasn't changed in 10 years either. And I think it's the same effect, right? Like people acquire these things or they build these things and then they become operators of it and they become expert operators of it. But the innovation part of it slowly dies away. And so, love to hear your opinion on why do you think that is? You think it's just the talent that did that left, the people with the product vision left, nobody wants to take any risk, like they're too big to change, like nobody has the willpower to cause all the change that has to ripple through if something has to be changed. Like what are the things that drive that?
What I've found is there's 2 personas that I look at in people. So everyone I kind of put in one or two buckets. You're either an innovator or you're an operator. And so what I mean by that is, and I'm not disparaging one or the other, but innovators, the analogy I use, innovators build race cars. You know, they design tires. They live in this abstract world of science and molding it into technology and making it into a tangible, consumable thing, right? So they build the race car. But then you have operators, the people who drive the race car and the pit crew that services the race car. Two different valuable things, but they both need each other. So a great race car driver can squeak out amazing performance from a well-designed and well-engineered race car, right? So you need them both. The problem is most companies prioritize the operator roles because it's easier to track. It's easier to create KPIs. It's easier to understand. And so the typical operator I always use is an MBA, Master's of Business Administration. It's in the title, Master's of Business Administration. Administration the same as operation. So most MBAs are trained to be great race car drivers. They're really good at operating that machine, and they'll squeak out every ounce of performance from it. They'll find efficiencies, and they do. They're just very bright and talented individuals. The problem comes when that machine is no longer competitive.
Right. Yep.
That somebody else creates a better machine. There is a lot more operators in the world than innovators now, which is just fascinating to me. And so companies predominantly have a psychological deficiency. So my background's in psychology. So I always think of this from a psychological problem. If you're an executive in business, chief level, let's just say, you rose to that usually through an MBA program. You probably went and got an MBA somewhere along the way. The majority of executives in the corporations around the world have a business administration background. And there's this bias that people have where they think the best person to solve a problem is someone similar to themselves. And so they keep on bringing in administrators or operators on to create innovation. And nothing against anyone that has an MBA, but I've met very few people who've gone through that type of program that can have the free association creativity needed to create the next. They constantly want to look at the data. They constantly want to look at facts. They constantly want to use Excel to innovate. And unfortunately, innovative ideas don't have facts yet. You have to go and create it and get first party data, and your innovation itself should be the first data that's ever created around that idea.
So let me ask you this. So, you know, I'm definitely an innovator. I'm not an operator. The last thing I want to do is drive the race car around in circles. That's boring. I want to build the race car. So do you think part of the problem is the innovators just also can't survive in this corporate world? I mean, do you think that flushes them out ultimately as well? Or, you know, why, you know, is there something to that too?
Most definitely. I mean, look at Elon Musk. He's a great innovator. I would argue probably not that good of an operator. He's talented. He has very smart people around him, but he's always stepping on people's toes. He can't operate a business like most people can. Would expect you to operate a large multinational like he's built with multiple of his companies. And so I just think it's a natural resonance. And what I found, and part of it's in my latest book, which is there's these 20 traits that we have that I've identified that innovators have. And our personality traits are things that are built on top of I won't bore you with all this, but it's built up from experiences and other things. But there's these 20 traits. Like, for example, curiosity is one of the traits. So curiosity to an innovator is a very powerful tool. If your personality, if you're naturally curious and want to go explore and see things and just understand and learn new things, it unlocks innovations eventually. Now, if you're an operator, curiosity is a tax, right? So curiosity is inefficient. Curiosity is expensive. Curiosity creates fear, uncertainty, and doubts. So curiosity is not a good personality trait on the operation side. So unfortunately, when you have these companies that are led by predominantly operators, they suppress actual traits that they want their employees to have that spark creativity. Another one is fierceness. People ask me, what is the number one trait people need to have to be a successful entrepreneur? Or what's the number one trait or the number one difference between entrepreneurs or startup founders in innovation, corporate innovation? And it's fierceness, hands down, it's fierceness. And the definition of fierceness is a powerful and heartfelt intensity. Now, in a startup, there is a lot of fierceness going on. There's a lot of intensity. And it's a lot of heartfelt. There's just a lot more emotion in startups, in the entrepreneur community as a whole, versus corporate. If you go into corporations, they hire Spocks. You go into a startup incubator and it's filled with Kirks. And so there's just a lot more passion, a lot more of the raw ingredients of where creativity comes from. And in the corporate environment, there's just a lot more logic, a lot more operation mindset. The cool and calculated operator is what we epitomize when we talk about success. And in the startup community, we're always, as any of the recent startup stories that we've seen in media play out, there's always these impassioned, crazily broken founders that create these amazing businesses. And I think that's what's really interesting about the two is most large companies do not allow their employees to think and act entrepreneurially because they don't want them to have the personality traits of the innovator.
So as you've worked with these big companies to be more entrepreneurial, how have you fixed that? You know, what do you do to get them to think differently or act differently?
Yeah, so the first thing I do is they unload their secrets to me, all their new innovations they're working on. And I'll sit in these meetings, and every single meeting, every single time, some operator will raise their hand and talk, or some executive will say, well, I think we ought to risk mitigate this further. And that's always my cue. And I stand up because I usually am anointed by the CEO to interrupt because I'm trying to bring the startup viewpoint or the entrepreneurial viewpoint into these meetings. And I was like, risk, that's a fascinating word, risk. The human emotion we feel when there's risk is fear. So let's reframe that. Instead of doing risk mitigation, let's call it what it truly is, which is fear mitigation. What are we afraid of? What are you personally afraid of? Why do you want us to go out and do more research and collect more data or hire Accenture to run some big report and give us some artificially inflated data? What are you afraid of? And then that changes. They start to think differently because I'm forcing them to be emotional instead of logical. It's really easy to say, let's do risk mitigation, but it's really hard to ask those same people to do fear mitigation work. And so what I do is I challenge people's assumptions and start to break down some of the barriers they have that prevent them from being more creative.
I mean, so ultimately, are they able to get their existing management teams and employees to do this new innovative work? Or do you also suggest that they create like new teams and new divisions to go do new things? Or how do you suggest they do that?
If the operational mindset, if their culture really is, I call it a Spock culture from Star Trek, if it truly is logical, and that's really how their culture operates, then they need to have a different set of rules for their innovators. So one, they need to hire more innovators. Here's a funny story. I was at this big company, embedded, and they were hiring a chief innovation officer. And they asked me, and I was like, if I would apply. And I was like, no, but I was interesting. So I went and looked at the actual job posting, and I didn't qualify. So the actual job posting, they came up, I wouldn't qualify for it because they required an MBA for the head of innovation. And so when I look at these organizations, I was like, it goes all the way down to that level.
Yeah.
That your HR department is hiring the wrong people. I was like, I built 20 tech startups. I have a 40-some% success rate. my technology, I have a whole list of accomplishments and things I've done in my startup community. I was like, and I talked to the head of HR. I was like, how do you value this? She goes, well, and I look at your resume and it shows that you're constantly switching jobs. I was like, that's because I kill my startups quicker. And she goes, yeah, but it just doesn't look good on your resume. And I was like, so you're self-selecting away from people who are curious mm-hmm. and trying new things and experimenting and failing and learning. You want people who are more reliable, more, I mean, what is it you're looking for? And what they come back every single time, it's this list that describes an operator and not an innovator. They don't want people like you. They don't want yeah. people like me. And that's exactly what these large companies need.
You'll appreciate this. I always say when I go to hire software developers, like if they come in and they interview and they're wearing a suit and tie and all this stuff and they're all super professional, I'm like, this is not the person. But if they come in and they are like super weird, they came in dressed like a Jedi Knight, whatever, I'd be like, you're hired on the spot. Like this is the right person. Because exactly. Usually the weirder they are, the better they are, I'm telling you.
I'm lucky. I was EIR at Molson Coors, right? So this is when I lived in Colorado. I grew up in Golden and lived in Golden. So being part of Molson Coors was just, I grew up in Coors was iconic throughout my whole childhood. So the chance to be an entrepreneur in residence at Molson Coors was just too good to pass up. And they had a skyscraper downtown and top floors of the skyscraper. And that's the head of innovation was in the skyscraper. And his name's Scott Cooper. And so he was my counterpart. He was kind of responsible, global head of innovation. And I would show up to meetings in jeans and a hoodie and a t-shirt every single time. And no one else dressed that way. Nope. And once someone asked me, it's like, why don't you dress to match a client? I was like, I dress this way on purpose. They're like, why do you dress this way on purpose? I go, one, it's comfortable and I like it. But two, I'm an innovator. And by my very nature, I'm going to dress differently than your operators to identify me as separate, right? So I am part of the creative class. I'm not part of the operational class. I need to fit in with my peers because I usually would leave there and go mentor at a startup program in Denver. And I was like, if I show up to the startup community to mentor at, say, Founders Institute, Techstars, pick any of them, in a suit and tie, no one will take me serious. They'll think I'm selling them something. They'll think I have no expertise. But if I show up in a hoodie and a t-shirt and I have to rely on my experience and my proven track record to be able to articulate better, people are just more receptive to creative people who dress a certain way than the operator side. And it's funny because that's part of our personalities though, right? So how I dress, how I think, how I evaluate. These are all things that I try to teach these corporate executives to open up a little bit more. Stop being so Spockish. Be a little more passionate like Kirk. And over time, you start to see again and again and again, they start to see with my involvement that my way is probably the better way. That continuing to operate based upon logic and data only by its very nature means that you're missing out on creating the next, whatever that's going to be. You will always be behind, and usually in a company because of just the process, so many people involved and the number of meetings, that usually means 6 months to a year to 2 years behind what's happening in other parts of the industry. And that makes them very, very nervous.
Well, I really appreciate you confirming my my myth about hiring.
You're spot on. I mean, creative people are naturally, if they have a personality that will allow them to dress a certain way, even to a meeting. I mean, think about it. An interview is kind of a big first impression thing. But if they're open enough to express their creativity, what are they going to do in a code review?
Sure. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah. So
well, I've really appreciated our episode today, and this has been awesome. I know you are also an author. I want to make sure you tell everybody about your book as well.
Yeah. So I have two. I have the one that came out in November is called Innovating Innovation. Why Corporate Innovation Struggles in the Age of the Entrepreneur. So that's the current book. It really is geared. Startups are tending to like it because it validates why people become a founder to begin with. But the corporate innovation crowd, I think, is getting a lot of value from it as well. It was a bestseller, so I'm really proud of that book. And then I have another one coming out in 2 months. So it's January right now, so it'll probably be out in March, April timeframe. And it's called Million Dollar Ideator, the surprisingly simple way to quickly create profitable ideas. So it's more of the workshop that I do with corporate or when I mentor at a startup, the process I go to come up with to create these million-dollar ideas or ideas that have value. And so that book will be out in a couple months.
Awesome. Well, as we wrap up the episode today, I do want to remind everybody, if you need to hire software developers, testers, or leaders, FullScale can help. We have the platform and the people to help you build and manage a team of experts. When you visit fullscale.io, all you need to do is answer a few questions and then let our platform match you up with our fully vetted, highly experienced team. At FullScale, we specialize in building long-term teams that work only for you. You can learn more at fullscale.io. So I really enjoyed this episode, and I really enjoyed your story of about your adversity and how you've overcome that. And I'm curious if you have any other final, you know, tips, thoughts, words of wisdom for other entrepreneurs listening today.
I think going into this economic season that we are, there's just a lot of fear. And I have the saying that scarcity breeds creativity. The more scarce money is, more scarce time is, more scarce talent is, it unlocks something unique in the human experience where we just come up with new connections in scarcity. So abundance breeds decadence, and we've gone through a decade of that. So I'm excited about this next phase, and I think the age of the entrepreneur is going to continue. We might be in for a rough ride economically, but now is the best time I've ever seen to work on an amazingly new idea. The world needs great innovators.
Well, and as you mentioned earlier, it's, you know, like using my company as an example that I had sold hasn't changed much in 10 years. Somebody's going to come by and disrupt them.
Yes.
Another entrepreneur will come by and see the opportunity, right? So it's like every you know, 10 years, whatever, these things continue to turn. So,
And I love that word, disrupt, because one of the exercises I do with corporate clients is, what is the definition of innovation? And for me, my definition that I came up with is the human response to evolution. So things are constantly changing, evolving. And if you don't respond to every evolution, then you are building up a dam of ignorance to the evolutions that are happening. And when you get to a certain point, that's disruption. When you ignore evolution long enough, it will disrupt you, or someone will disrupt you because someone was paying attention to the evolutions that were happening.
I think that's absolutely great. And that definitely happens with, you know, things like mobile or cloud and internet and all these different waves of things that happen, that if you totally ignore them, they definitely will catch you off guard. That's for sure. Well, yeah, thank you. Sure. Thank you so much for being on the show again. This was Mike Stemple. Can definitely find you on LinkedIn, find your books. I Googled your art. I'm a little sad that you're a John Elway fan. I mean, I'm a Kansas City guy, so.
Well, I've done Kansas City stuff. Yeah. I have to look at the database, but.
So go Chiefs, but, and your website is inspirer.com. And,
yeah, or you can go to mikestemple.com and it links out to everything.
All right.
Articles.
All right. Well, thanks again. Thank you for being on the show.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed our conversation.
Startup Hustle's brought to you by FullScale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.